You don't just think it's going to work, you know it's going to work. Your friends will tell you that you're crazy and that you should give up. And I think that's partly because there's a little bit of all your friends that doesn't actually want you to succeed. People take a business from zero to £10 million sales and they sell. The hard thing to do is to take it from zero to 10. Somebody comes along, buys it, takes from 10 to 100, so makes it worth 10 times as much. And that's probably 10 times easier than going from 0 to 10.
Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? This week, my guest is the founder of one of the most quintessentially British brands ever. It's a brand that our entire nation can be proud of. In fact, he has been granted an OBE by the Queen herself. He is Nicholas Charles Tyrwhitt Wheeler, the founder and owner of Charles Tyrwhitt, one of the biggest and highest quality men's shirt businesses in the world. His wife is none other than Chrissy Rucker, who is the founder and owner of The White Company, one of the biggest and highest quality home boutique businesses in the world. They both grew their businesses from nothing as sole founders without any funding, which is very different to the traditional path that most businesses follow. So let's say he knows one or two things about business and has some thoroughly fascinating views and ideas on how to approach business and life. He was a fantastically humbling person to be around, and I can't say how grateful I was to be let into his home to record this conversation. We cover all things from his childhood to the problems facing entrepreneurs just starting out and onto the issues of running a large business. So it's not every day that someone, in a very humble way, manages to make you gently feel just really quite stupid. But this whole conversation, I just felt a little bit in awe and I left it feeling fundamentally different. So it is with great pleasure that I can now share this conversation with you, and I hope that you can also learn as much as I did from the fountain of wisdom that is Nick Wheeler. And I'd love it if you would consider supporting me on Patreon. You can find my page at patreon.com/growthmindset and chuck me anything from a dollar upwards, and I will genuinely be eternally grateful for your support. Again, that's patreon.com/growthmindset. What was your first business idea?
I think my first business idea was, I think I decided I wanted to do an import-export business. Don't really know why, but that was sort of at school. Actually, my first business was doing a photography business at school, which when I was 13. We had this sort of ridiculous tradition where we'd take photos of, the leavers would have photos taken of themselves, which they'd then stick on a bit of card and give 200 of them to their friends, and they'd write little messages on the card. It's actually quite a nice tradition, in fact. Mm. So you end up, it's a sort of, you end up with these sort of memories or reminders of your friends and what they said to you when you were 13 to 18. And it's quite interesting to read them back sometimes. You realise what a sort of idiot you were. But I did those photographs for people. So people would order 200 photographs and I'd take the picture and then I'd have them developed and printed. So that was my first business. Quite good, actually. You know, I made a couple hundred quid a term, which, you know, back in 1978 was quite a lot of money.
Yeah, for a 13-year-old.
For a 13-year-old, it was good. And then I sort of thought, well, I want to do it. Then I thought import-export. And I don't know why I thought that. I think I must have seen a business that was importing and exporting and thought that seemed like a sort of good way to grow a big business. I always wanted to have my own business. That was sort of, I just knew I wanted my own business. I never wanted to work for anybody else. I used to have holiday jobs and never really liked it. I never liked being told what to do. And the same at school, actually. I didn't like being told what to do. I didn't like that sort of teacher-pupil sort of relationship where they could sort of tell you what to do. I always thought I wanted to be in control of my own destiny, I always used to call it, which is, you know, when I get up in the morning, I want to be able to do whatever I want to do. I don't want to be told what to do. I don't want to be told I've got to be in by 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock or 7 o'clock. I don't want to be told I've got to do some prep. You know, I want to do stuff because I want to do it, not because I'm told to do it.
Yeah, I totally understand. I often didn't get along with my teachers when I started because I wouldn't necessarily learn in the same way as other people, but I was always a good pupil. So like by the end of like the year or so, I'd always be like one of my favourites. But to start off with, they were like, oh, stop being a dick. Like, just do this homework. And I'm like, but what was the point? Mm. And I kind of always question their authority, which would be annoying. Mm. And it was the same, I guess, with my first jobs and things where I was like, but it's so much more sensible to do it this way. Why are you telling me to do it that way? And yeah, it kind of pissed me off. And I was like, okay, I don't think I want to work for people.
Same.
Okay. So did you have a lot of other ideas before you then got to Charles Tewitt? And did you go to university or?
I did the photography, which then evolved. I used to go and stand on the bridges at these big rowing, not regattas, but the big rowing head of the rivers. So you get sort of, you know, you stand on Hammersmith Bridge or Putney Bridge, and you get these, I don't know if you've ever seen them, but these school and university and rowing club races where you get literally 1,000 boats will come down the river. Mm. I mean, I assume they still happen. So you stand on the bridge and you take a picture of each boat as it comes under.
Yeah.
And then you send them a proof and they'd all order a print. And, you know, you literally get 1,000 boats going down and that's 8,000 people, or some of them were fours, but, you know, a hell of a lot of people. Few of them, they'd order prints. And that was pretty good. And then when I left school, I took a year off between school and university and I went traveling and I went to India and I found these shoes in northern India and Simla. And I thought, God, these are the best shoes. I didn't think it at the time, but when I came back, went to university. And about a year into university, I suddenly thought, these are the best shoes I've ever had in my life. You know, they cost me £10. They're handmade, made to measure shoes. I'm going to start a business. I'm going to be the best shoe business in the world. And so I got some orders for shoes and off I went. And it was a complete disaster, actually, because I sort of rather fell foul of two things. One was Indian phone lines were not very good at the time. And also fax machine technology was not very good. So I trace around people's feet and take the measurements around their instep and all these little sort of measurements and send them off on a bit of paper. And what I didn't realise is that on a fax machine, it would go in my end a normal size 8 shoe or 9 shoe or 10 shoe, and it would come out the other end like some bloody great big, you know, massive shoe or tiny shoe. And I got these 50 pairs of shoes, which were literally shoes for pixies and clowns, but not a single pair fitted. And so that was a disaster. So having thought it was going to be, you know, the greatest business in the world,
yeah.
And then I just sort of thought, crikey, what can I do instead of shoes? This is not going to work. And I just thought shirts. You know, a lot of people come to me now and they say, God, you know, I always wanted to start my own business, but I can never think of anything what to do. Or I want to start my own business, but I can't think of anything to do. They think the idea is the big thing. And I think, you know, the idea is not the big thing. It's the execution. It's always the execution. And you look around a room and there's 101 different business ideas in any room. You know, you could, you're sitting in here, you could make that table or that candle or that lamp or a picture or whatever, you know, whatever. And you just make it better than anybody else. And you give me, you know, it's better quality, better value, better service. Just go out and do it better than other people. It's a good example. Shirts, you know, shirts is sort of, you know, it's not a clever idea. It's not a revolutionary idea. It's not, there was nothing clever about it. You know, I just went out and I did shirts better than other people. And that was it, really.
So you said you wanted to be the world's best shoe maker, and then you kind of went into shirts with you really high quality and like world's best shirts.
Yeah.
If you want to claim that.
Were you always
focused on quality then, do you think?
I think I was always focused on the customer. So you ask a customer, what do they want? You know, no, very few customers are going to say, well, I want a bad quality product. They might say they want a cheap product, but they're not going to say they want a bad quality product. You know, quality comes in different shapes and sizes. There is quality that you can wear something once and not tell the difference between something that's very cheap and very expensive. But after 10 washes or after one wash, it'll be very apparent that one is very different. So you get someone like Primark who makes a product that is actually, you wear, you put it on, it's not a bad product. You know, it looks pretty good. You know, the Daily Mail is forever comparing this Primark dress with the Chanel dress. And can you spot the difference in a photograph? And, you know, it looks pretty good. So people don't say they want bad quality. If you're going to start a business, I think you start from the point that you've got to give people the quality you think they want. Now, in a men's shirt, it's not really like it's not a once-only wear. You know, a lot of women's clothing is once-only wear. A lot of women, they only want to wear something once. So they don't want to be seen twice in the same thing. I mean, it's sort of this crazy idea that men never quite understand.
Yeah.
But with men, they don't want a shirt that's going to fall apart because they don't want to feel ripped off. So if you come at it from what the customer wants, they want good quality, but they want good value for money. And they just want good service because they don't want, you know, men are generally pretty sort of, you know, they want things to be easy. They, you know, they don't want a load of hassle about stuff. So they want good service. You know, if they order something, they want it to arrive and not to have to chase it and not to have to. So I just thought, right, I'm going to give a great quality, great value, great service, which is not exactly rocket science, but it's something that I always, you know, for the last 32 years, I've always tried to stick to. We haven't always got it right. And I get lots of letters from customers saying that, you know, our quality is terrible, or our service is terrible. But equally, I get a hell of a lot more letters saying they absolutely love the quality and they love the service.
Mm.
and the value for money.
Okay, cool. You said it wasn't very innovative, but do you think you've been quite innovative around the business model in terms of providing people a quality service and making it easy for them to buy your shirts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, when I started in 1986, if you wanted to buy a good quality shirt, you had to go to a shop, basically. And there weren't that many shops selling good quality shirts. You know, the inspiration for when I started the business, you know, I always loved going down German Street. German Street, sort of the world's shirt street, or it is to me, and it is to a lot of people. So if you want to get to German Street, you have to come to London, you have to go to Piccadilly, and you have to go down German Street. And then the shirts there were very expensive. And so what I did is because I was at University of Bristol. I couldn't have a shop, partly because I didn't have any money. And also, I had to go to a few lectures. So, I mean, the shop was out of the question. So I did mail order. And I think, mail order, that was quite innovative. At the time, mail order was very much a quite down market. You know, it was sort of dominated by what we used to call the big books, which are sort of Grattan's, Littlewood's, GUS. And they had, you know, these huge books selling cheap stuff, often on credit. And it was quite a down and dirty market. And what I was doing was selling a good quality product by mail order. And that was different.
Cool. So it solved kind of problems for you and your customers at the same time.
Yeah. It gave people access to great quality shirts. And I think in many ways, you know, upmarket mail order was a precursor. And obviously, we didn't know the internet was going to come along. But when the internet did come along, it was like manna from heaven. It was like whoopee-doo. You know, when the internet, as soon as the internet, first inklings of the internet, I knew that was going to be very important for my business. It completely changed it. It changed mail order from down and dirty to being quite sexy.
So, the right business at the right time.
Yeah, the right business at the right time.
So, in terms of your growth, did it grow steadily and then explode when the internet arrived?
I always think it's quite interesting for people who are starting their own businesses or who want to start their own business or who have started their own business and it's not going as well as they think it should do. Because for the first 4 years of doing Charles Tyrion, I did £12,000 a year, nothing more, nothing less. So it was tiny and it didn't grow and everybody said to pack it in. But I think, you know, the really important thing when you start a business is to learn. You learn about your business, you learn about your customers, you learn about your product. And a lot of people, the first thing they want to do is go out and raise a load of money. So they give away a load of their equity and they raise a load of money. And then with that money, they go out and they make these ridiculous mistakes. I think it's when you have no money and you're just trying to sort of learn as you go, you can't make the mistakes because you just can't lose the money because you don't have it. You become an expert, but a sort of an expert with a tiny business. And that's actually a much more solid platform to build a business from. So having done £12,000 a year for the first 4 years, I think I then went to 70,000 and then 150,000 and then 350,000 and 1.3 million and then 2.5 million. So it started doubling, tripling each year. And that's because I knew what I was doing. I wasn't a complete novice.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So how did you fund those first few years when you weren't making much money? You just had enough money to get by?
Well, I was doing £12,000 a year. So it just didn't really need any funding. I mean, when I first started, I had 5,000 leaflets printed for 99 quid. Mm. I bought an Amstrad word processor for 199 quid. So that was £298. I was talking to a friend and I said, I'm going to start this shirt business. I mean, I'd just done no research. A lot of people say you've got to do lots of research. I always found if you do too much research when you're starting a business, you'll generally not start because you'll find lots of reasons not to start because everybody's done everything already. And if you speak to people, they'll generally sort of put you off. And I just think I'm a great one, but just get on with it and you just give it a go. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, then you go and do something else. Mm. You can pivot.
Yeah, you can learn from your failures.
You learn from fail fast. You know, it's the old cliche. Talking to a friend, I said, I'm going to start a shirt business. And they said, oh, where are you going to get the shirts from? And I said, oh, that's a really good question. I hadn't really thought about that. And they had a friend whose father had made cotton up in Lancashire. And I rang him and I said, can I buy fabric from you? And he said, no, you can't buy fabric from me, but you can I've got an agent in Nelson in Lancashire. You can go and speak to him. So I spoke to him and said, I'm going to start a shirt business. Can I buy some fabric from you? And it was ridiculous. It was so naive. Anyway, he said, yeah, come and see me. So, you know, I just went and bought a few shirt lengths, a few quid each. So, I mean, the whole thing was probably, I don't know, 400 quid. So I worked at Victoria Wine, made a bit of money. And each time I sold a shirt, it gave me a little bit more money so I could buy a little bit more fabric. It was great doing it when I was at university because I was under the umbrella of being at university. So it didn't really matter that the business wasn't exactly doing very well.
Yeah, so if it all goes wrong, you kind of go home and live with your mum, which is...
If it all goes wrong, anyway. I was still doing my degree. It was a hobby. So it's braver to sort of suddenly announce to the world that you're going off and you're starting your own business and you're out on your own and you've got to pay your rent and you've got to pay your, you know, everything. It's just sort of, then it's hard. But I did it at university for 2 years and then I did get a job, which is the only job, proper job I've ever had, which was with Bain & Company, which is a management consultancy. And I spent 2 years there, but I did it on the side while I was there as well. And it's that was pretty good. In a way, 24 hours is a long time. And people don't like the idea of having a job and doing a business. But I think it actually works really well because 24 hours is, you know, a normal job is you got to work 8 hours a day or 9 hours, whatever it is. Bain was actually a bit harder than that because they expected to, you know, work long hours. But you still get, you know, you can still do, you know, you sleep for 6 hours and you work for 12 hours. You know, you still got 6 hours to do your own business.
And it's a weekend.
You've got weekends and, yeah.
That's together.
Yeah, so it worked pretty well.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. So you then had the job for 2 years or longer?
I worked at Bain for 2 years.
Oh, so you were doing Charles Hill all by yourself still at that point?
I was doing it by myself, yeah.
Wow. So you ran it solo for 4 years and then were you able to employ people? Did you?
I left Bain and I went and I rented my first little office, which was where Chelsea Football Club is now, which is a building that's since been knocked down. And I just sat there on my own in this little room, surrounded by shirt boxes, with a phone line, my first ever phone line. Yeah, you know, people wanted to order, they had to send a check because I couldn't take credit card because the bank wouldn't let me take credit card because they didn't trust me. And I didn't even have a phone line because I didn't have my own phone. I didn't have mobile phones and I didn't have a landline. So if people wanted to order, they just had to send a check by post. Mm. So it was all sort of fairly haphazard. But then finally, I had my own little office and I had a phone and I was surrounded by boxes and it was tiny. But it was good fun, actually.
Yeah. Did you ever stop and think, oh my God, I'm a little bit crazy right now? Or did your friends think you're weird?
I think you have to. I think most entrepreneurs have an optimistic streak or a gene where they just think it's going to work. And I think that's quite important. You don't just think it's going to work, you know it's going to work. And your friends will tell you that you're crazy and that you should give up. And I think that's partly because there's a little bit of all your friends that actually want you to succeed. And that sounds rather mean, but especially the ones who have gone down that traditional route of going into the professions or an accountant or a lawyer or being an entrepreneur, they almost don't want you to succeed. And so they're forever giving you advice that you should pack it in and do something sensible.
Yeah, I spoke with a guy who started a business and sold it for like 10 million 2 years later and said like a lot of his friends now aren't his friends. They kind of didn't want to succeed. Did you have any issues with friends that you thought were your friends but then just really became a problem?
No, I think if anything, it's the other way around. I mean, it's, you know, your friends when you don't have anything tend to be the friends that you have a choice. And I suppose, and people go both ways. Sometimes people who, their old friends, they then lose if they make a load of money because they then start mixing with a load of other people who made a load of money. Or there are people who, they make a load of money, but they stick with their old friends. And I think it's much, for your own sanity, it's a hell of a lot better and more fun to stick with your friends you have when you didn't have any money. Because otherwise you end up with the people who are, they are your friends because you've made some money. And that's not the healthiest place to be.
You're stuck with having to have money to be in the friend circles and things.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So, yeah, back to the business. We got to the point where you're surrounded by boxes. So how did you then start growing from there with taking on employees?
I spent a year in that office and then I persuaded a guy called Pete Higgins, who used to work with me at Bain, to come. He came and joined me. And basically the two of us then moved to a little office at the top of Ladbroke Grove. And for 4 years, we were the only two employees because we subcontracted stuff out. So we subcontracted fulfillment, which in a way is a good business model. And some of the businesses I really admire, some of these businesses that have very few employees, but incredibly successful businesses, because it's just quite clever. And I think Fevertree would be an example. They used to have about 35 employees and it's now, you know, it's worth four and a half billion quid now. It's come down a bit actually. But, it's quite clever. It's sort of, you decide what you're good at and you just do that. I've always been a big believer in focus. So you decide what you're good at and do that. And anything you're not good at, anything that's not core, you get other people to do who are experts in their own field. So you get fulfillment, people who are experts in fulfillment, you get experts in call center, you can obviously subcontract finance, you can subcontract all the different roles, but I think you have to decide what your core strength is. And I think in a business like shirts, the core thing we were good at was marketing and merchandising, really. So we subcontracted the other things out in the early years. We've now brought them all in-house. And actually, I believe quite strongly in having them in-house because I believe in customer service. And I want to have, you know, people who live and breathe Charles Tyrwhitt working for our customer services.
Okay, that makes sense. Did you have any major failures or setbacks as you were going along?
I have had loads of failures. I mean, typically the failures happen when you... I think as an entrepreneur, you are either a hare or a tortoise. There are some entrepreneurs who go out and first thing they do, as I said earlier, is they raise a load of money and they're off and running and they've got backers who expect them to perform to a certain degree and at a certain pace. And they have to get out and they have to build their business fast. And if they don't, invariably they get chucked out and it's no longer their business. I'm more a tortoise, so I've never had any outside financial investment. And I just want to build the business at my own pace and my own speed. And I think both being a hare and a tortoise is subject to a good chance of failure. And I think one of the failures you have as a tortoise is what I always believed was that business was common sense and that I didn't know anything about business. You know, I did geography at university. I didn't go to business school. I just didn't know anything about it. I just sort of did what I thought was right. And what tends to happen, I think the danger is when if you're a tortoise, you tend to grow your business quite slowly, which is nothing wrong with that. But you can get bored. And what I found is that when you get bored, you tend to lose focus because to be successful, I think you have to decide what you're good at and just be ruthlessly focused on that. So we were selling men's shirts by mail order. And Pete and I are sitting in the little room together and we got the business up to a few years in. We went from 350 to 1.3 to 2.5. So we were 2.5 million quid sales and making 250,000 quid profit, which suddenly was, you know, having had people tell me that it was a complete waste of time a few years earlier because I was doing £12,000 a year, I was making 250,000 quid a year profit, which was, you know, suddenly it was sort of a lot more than they were making doing their rather sensible jobs. And you suddenly think that actually it's rather easy and actually you want to do something else rather than concentrating on being the best men's shirt business in the world. And what we did is we went off and bought a chain of children's clothes shops, which was a complete disaster. I didn't know anything about retail. I didn't know anything about children's clothes. Completely different customer base. Men didn't want to buy children's clothes, I discovered pretty quickly. Mm. And lost more money in 3 months than I'd made in the last 3 years and went bust. So that was a big mistake. And I think the mistake was it is just that losing focus thing. If you want to do something well, then do one thing and do it well. As soon as you start doing two things, you're with the best will in the world, whoever you are, you're going to do each thing half as well as you would have done it if you were doing the one thing. You know what I mean? And I think a lot of entrepreneurs that don't succeed as entrepreneurs, it's because their head is turned very easily and they end up trying to do 15 things at the same time and they do none of them well and they all fail. So that was a big mistake, losing focus and going bust. And actually, we got the business back and then we carried on growing. And 10 years later, we were doing £40 million sales, making £4 million profit. So again, you know, we were back selling shirts to men and it was, you know, we were focused. And then it was the same situation. It was almost thinking that there must be more out there. And it was a bit boring. It was sort of the same old, same old. You come into work every day and you're selling more shirts to more men. It was feeling that there must be more to it than this. And we actually, what we did is we brought in a chief exec in to run the business, which is always an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing as an entrepreneur when you bring in a chief exec in. Should you bring a chief exec in? And we brought a guy in from Ralph Lauren, and he started selling, slightly embarrassingly, women's and children's clothing, which was the same mistake we'd made 10 years earlier. And we very nearly went bust again. I mean, it's sort of history repeating itself. But it is that thing of it was just a loss of focus again.
Mm. Yeah, that's pretty good advice. I've certainly had the same thing as an entrepreneur. It's got lots of ideas. I've always been trying to do like five things at once. And now I'm only doing two things. And at least it's always the same two things. And I'll see my friends like a year later and they're like, Sam, what are you doing? Wait, you're doing the same thing? And so at least I've kind of got more focus there. And it's amazing to watch myself getting better at the things that I'm doing as well.
Yeah.
And see you getting it more traction.
I think the great thing, if you do one thing, Because again, a lot of people come to me and they say, I've been running my business for 4 years or 5 years and it hasn't really taken off. And should I give up and do something else? Or you know, what's your advice? Or what can I do to get it to really take off? And I think my advice, you know, there's no magic dust that you can sprinkle on a business. And basically, I say, look, you know, just focus on the one thing and be the best. You know, I've done it for 32 years. Do it for 32 years. And in 32 years, I can guarantee you will have a great business. But it's sort of easier said than done because a lot of people, you know, 32 years is a sort of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And, you know, you only get one lifetime. People think, God, I don't want to be doing the same thing for 32 years. I want more excitement than that. But actually, if you can get a business really working, it is very exciting and it does evolve and change. And even if you're selling the same, doing the same thing, it changes a lot.
Yeah, every time you grow, so much stuff changes. So many things. But I would like to ask you, because I was running a business as a student as well, which did go quite well. It's like a Deliveroo style business, basically, but without the tech side of things. And so I had some issues and I got distracted by other things and I ended up selling the business, but that was quite lucky. But I've since kind of been quite sporadic and going on doing loads of different things. I think had I been running a business like yours, I probably would have got distracted by quite a few other things if I'd done it at that age. How did you have the maturity to be, this is the one thing from so young? Or did you learn that by accident from the other things you've tried to go into?
I think it was a slightly different time. So it was a time where, you know, now it feels like everybody is starting their own business. There is a tech revolution that's been going on for a while now and will continue to go on for a long while into the future, I think. But, you know, a lot of people are starting their business, a lot of different ideas. There's a lot of people who have done incredible things in very short periods of time within the tech sector. And so there is more to turn your head now than there was then. Back then, very few people started their own business. It was a sort of, you know, people tended to go and work for a company. They'd work for them for a long time. You know, that's changed a lot now. I think the power is much more in the hands of the employee rather than the employer. It used to be you had to stay 5 years, otherwise your CV looked like a mess. Now it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, people move for good reason and they move a lot. And if they don't like something, they move. You know, the employer doesn't have that same power anymore. Same in a way with businesses have changed. It used to be that, you know, the business had the power, and now there's been a shift. The customer's got the power. You know, the internet's been quite responsible for that. But, you know, in the good old days, you know, I was looking at, you know, John Lewis used to close at 1 o'clock on Saturday lunchtimes. You know, Saturday is the biggest shopping day there is. People go shopping on a Saturday. They close because they wanted to close on Saturday. And now the customer says, I want to shop on Saturday, and therefore, you know, they have to open. Businesses have to do what the customer wants rather than the customer doing what the business wants. There's been a whole sort of shift over the last 20, 30 years. And so it was easier for me to not be distracted than it would be now. But I still don't think it actually changes my view that focus is a very important part of success.
No.
And I think even those guys who've built these huge tech businesses, they've been incredibly focused.
Yeah, it's the barriers to entry are much smaller, which means it's easier to start, but it's a lot harder to focus when you can see another business idea that you can easily go and start in a month.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, but maybe I'll just try this other thing. And then you lose focus on your current business, and it turns out that one actually does take a year to start.
Everything is always much harder than you think it's going to be.
This is so true. Cool. Okay. So on to mindset. How did you make sure that you were kind of living in the sort of the growth mindset sort of things rather than like a fixed mindset of I'm good at this and this is the only thing I'm good at? Like, how did you learn to deal with other problems? Because I know you said, like, I'm an expert at this, I'll only do this. But you must have been an expert at just being the person picking up the phone and sending like a PS to being an expert as the person managing employees.
I think the important thing, I suppose, picking up something I sort of touched on earlier, but it's, you know, I think the biggest decision any entrepreneur has to make is who is the right person to run my business. And for a long time, it will probably be the entrepreneur, but there will generally come a time when it's no longer the entrepreneur who's the right person to run the business. Somebody else is the right person to run the business. And what happens, a lot of entrepreneurs never give up running their business. They always carry on running it. And that's because they think they're the best person to run the business. I think entrepreneurs are split into two types of people. It's the people who think they're the best person to run the business, and it's the people who don't think they're the best person to run the business.
Yeah.
It's sort of been quite simplistic. But I have never thought that I'm the best person to run the business. I've always felt other people could do it better than me. The chances of me being the best person in the whole world to run the business are basically absolutely zero. And you break it down into component parts. You know, when I sat in that room on my own, I packed the boxes and I answered the phones and I did the marketing and the merchandising and the finance and the, you know, everything. I didn't really know anything about anything, but I sort of learned as I went along. And then as you build a business, you start saying, well, hang on a minute, I'll get somebody else to answer the phones. And so somebody else answers the phones, who then concentrates on answering the phones. And after about a week, you're looking at them and you're thinking, crikey, they're better than me. Mm. They're much better than me answering the phones. And you get somebody to start packing the boxes. God, and you know, they're much better than I am at packing the box. Within a week, where you were doing everything and for half an hour at the end of the day, you were packing a few boxes and doing it rather slowly and a bit clumsy. They're spending all day packing the boxes, and within hours, they're doing it better than you were.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the same when you do the merchandise. You know, so eventually, you stop doing the merchandising. You stop doing the marketing. You get a marketing director in, and they construct the marketing, and you suddenly realize they're much better. And the only thing left is you're running the business. And the natural progression, as long as you have the right mindset, is that somebody's better at doing all these things, that somebody's going to be better at running this business than me. And you know, running a business when you're one person sitting in a room on Chelsea football pitch is very different to we've got 1,100 people in the business. Suddenly you realize that I'm not the right person. And that's when you get somebody else in, and suddenly you're going, wow, you know, you look at them and they're doing a much better job than you were doing.
Yeah.
And the business sort of suddenly starts doing very well when it wasn't doing, you know, if it wasn't doing very well when you were doing it.
It's a really humbling feeling when you get someone to do what you were doing that you thought you were doing well, and suddenly you're like, oh, you're so much better at this than me. And
it's not only humbling, it is just the most fantastic feeling.
Yeah, it feels great. You're like, oh, wow.
You know, I look at some entrepreneurs, you know, they're doing 100-hour weeks, and they've done 100-hour weeks since they started their business, which could have been a long time ago. And they're not doing 100-hour weeks because they really want to do 100-hour weeks. They're doing it because they feel they have to do 100-hour weeks, otherwise the whole business falls apart. Mm. Whereas I think Richard Branson always says, you know, one of the most important things when you're running a business is to every year take 3 months off and disappear, and you let people get on with it. And you suddenly, when you see them get on with it, actually, they do a much better job than you did. And so you end up being the business owner, but not running it.
But you don't have to be Richard Branson to do that either.
No, you don't have to be Richard Branson to do that. Not at all.
Yeah. Do you know Richard Branson?
I've met him. Yeah. I've met him quite a few times. Well, I remember actually quite clearly the first time I read an article about Richard Branson, which was when I was 12 at prep school. And I remember the room I was in when I read the article. He's an iconic entrepreneur. For certainly anybody in Britain, he was one of the first real true entrepreneurs, somebody who was sort of buccaneering, pioneering, totally irreverent, been an inspiration for a lot of people. I mean, I've met him a lot, Fast Track, they build league tables of fastest growing business, and I think Virgin are a big sponsor, so we've been on those tables, and I've met him through that, but he's not a great friend.
Cool.
But he is an inspiration.
Yeah, I remember really aspiring to him when I was younger. Still do. But back to the point that you don't have to be already in that state to be able to go and take 3 months off from your business. You can do that as a person who's kind of starting their business in the first few years. You can actually sort of step back and get things to run themselves.
Yeah, you can. I mean, I think the first few years, it's as I was saying, it is the most important decision of an entrepreneur's life.
Yeah.
It's who is the right person to run my business? And there comes a point when it's not you. The chance of it not being you in the first couple of years is, it depends on the business. So never say never, but it's...
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's probably, you know, if you're suddenly taking 3 months off after you've been doing it for a year, there's a chance the whole thing is going to fall flat in its
face. I kind of want to take that statement back. Actually, I did, with my first business, like I said, I got a bit distracted. But at the end of the first year, I'd been running it really hard and nearly failed my degree because I was running out of lectures to take calls and do things and just doing so much work outside of uni. And then by the summer of after the first year, I wasn't getting that much traction, and I was just getting so depressed by working so hard. I just randomly went to Ibiza and for a weekend with my friend, and then that was awful. Turns out I didn't like Ibiza, but I went to Germany for 3 weeks after that, and I'd left this one guy that I'd interviewed to run my business for me, and he completely screwed it up. But there's one other person that got interviewed who came and was doing the deliveries, and he basically just ran my business, and I came back and he was running it, and then he became my business partner, and
yeah.
So it worked perfectly, but
yeah.
It was not planned and not a good decision, technically speaking, but it happened to be really lucky.
I think the longer you've been in business, the more you realise that, I'm not really in the shirt business, actually, or the men. I'm not even in the men's clothing business. I'm in... You're in a people business, and it's about choosing the right people, and it's about empowering the right people, and that's what makes a business successful or not.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no good me thinking every morning, how am I going to sell a few more shirts? It's more, how am I going to get the right people in the right position in this business to take it forward? That's the real decision.
Yeah. So how do you make those decisions in the best way possible?
How do you choose the right people? That's
the better wording of the question. Yes,
that's the That is the million-dollar question. The problem is that the right people in one business are going to be the wrong people in another business because, you know, it's the whole cultural fit. It's a complicated puzzle. As you get more experience and as you get, I suppose, more wisdom, for want of a better word, you become a better judge of people. You've seen a lot of people. You get to the point, I've been doing this business 32 years, I've seen a lot of people coming and going from the business. And I've seen a lot of people who've been successful in the business and a lot of people who've been failures. And you start to spot certain trends. And it's not really something that if I went to work in a business making sofas in Cheltenham, I'd be pretty useless at choosing the right people. It's a different culture and it's a completely different fit and everything's different. So it's not something that's easily translatable. You know, I can't, if people come to me and they say, how do I choose the right people? And the answer is, I haven't got a clue. You know, you've got to understand your business. You've got to know, you know, what is it? You've got to understand the essence of your business. And what is it that people are going to like about it and not like about it? And what are your, you know, what are the important things to you as the founder that you want to instill within the culture of the business? And you've got to take it from there. So it's a sort of, it's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah, like, it'd be great to have like what are the top five signs to look for when employing people kind of thing. But it's really hard. And in the same way with, I don't know, like relationships, if you ask me what my three most important things are, like why I'll swipe right on Tinder or not, it's very different to who I've ended up having good relationships with, of who I think I should be with. So yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Are there any signs you majorly look for when you're interviewing someone?
I want people who have positive energy, however long you're going to spend at work. You know, whether it's 7 hours a day or 10 hours a day, whatever it is, it's going to be quite a lot of hours.
Yes.
You know, it's a large part of your life.
How do you screen for that? Because when in an interview, you only have like an hour, maybe 2 hours. Like, how do you know that they're going to turn up for like 5 days a week?
Well, you just know. No, well, I think you assume, and people generally are going to, people will generally turn up for whatever they're meant to turn up for. I mean, that's not the point. It's more that, you know, they're going to be around you for a lot of your life. Yes. And if they're going to be around you, the thing I really want is I want them to be quite good fun. I want to be around them, not I don't want to be around them. We all know people, whether you walk into a room and you see them and you think, I don't want to talk to that guy or that woman because they're just going to be, they're going to be whinging about something or moaning about something or not coming up with any solutions or not being funny. And I want to be with people who are going to be fun. I want them to be uplifting and I want them to make it fun and I want them to be can-do and positive and have a great attitude. And I think that's sort of the most important thing, especially in a business like ours, where we are all customer facing, whether that customer is the actual end customer or whether it's somebody else within the business. And we all have to deal with customers. Even if you're in the merchandising team, it might be somebody in the marketing team. They're your customer. You've got to have that positive mental attitude.
Yeah. Okay, cool. How do you keep things fun? There's all these tech startups now that are sort of going like limited holiday and ping pong in the office.
We do quite a lot of stuff. We don't like it to be prescribed. The company says this and the company says that. We have something called the post box, which anybody who has an idea about something they think should change in the business. What I say to people, because I meet all the new starters and I say, look, the most important thing here is that your attitude should be, if this was my business, what would I do? So if you see something in this business that it's not what you would do if it was your business, then you should make sure it changes. And if it doesn't change, you should understand why it doesn't change. So you should go to your manager and say, look, I think we should do this. And they will turn around and say, well, we don't do that because of this. And then if you agree with that, that's fine. And then you can understand what the point of view of the business is. And if you don't agree, then you say, well, actually, I don't agree. I still think it should change because of this. And it becomes a business where everybody is thinking like the owner of the business. And everybody is doing what they would do if it was their business. And so we have a post box where you put stuff into the post box, which is anonymous. But every third Thursday of the month, we have a big get-together in the kitchen. The CEO stands up and he goes through every single thing that's gone into that post box.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether there's 500 things or 50 things or 3 things. Every single thing he goes through every single one and he says whether we're going to do it and if we're not going to do it, why we're not going to do it. And if anybody wants to come and have a chat with me about it, then come and have a chat with me about it. So we do have table tennis. Each team will go out and do a sort of escape room or these sort of funny events. And there's a budget for all that. We go on sort of company days where we go to Belgium.
Nice.
40 of us went and did the Three Peaks the other day, which is fun. You know, sort of
hard work.
Hard work, actually. Yeah. In fact, actually, to be honest, nobody actually did it because we picked it. I wasn't there because I couldn't do it that weekend. But we got to Snowdon and the winds were 80 miles an hour, and they just said you're not allowed to get to the top.
Yeah.
So it was sort of
That's sad.
But it was most appalling weather on all of them. I mean, it was just an absolute, just the worst possible 24 hours to have chosen to do it. But it was hard work. But it's a fantastic thing to do because it's 40 people. Okay, it's not that many out of 1,100, but it's 40 people, all from different areas of the business, who all get to know people they didn't know in the business. And it creates a really strong bond.
Yeah.
And we do a lot of that stuff because I want it to be fun. Well, one of the jobs I had, I worked at Harrods, when I was at school. And I remember I worked in the golfware department, and I spent the first day looking around, and the guy had worked, he'd run the golfware department for 20 years, the guy who ran it, he kept telling me he'd run this department for 20 years. So I came in on the second day, I said, look, I know you've been running it for 20 years, but I've made this list of things that I think you should change. And I thought it was a pretty good list, pretty good ideas. I was at school, so I wasn't exactly the most experienced person. I didn't really even like golf, but I thought they were quite good ideas. And he immediately put me into luggage. He just wasn't interested. And I remember thinking, God, when I have my own business, I don't want that. I want a business where people will be listened to and the business will react and we will make a difference and we will get better the whole time. It doesn't matter whether we're 1 year old or 32 years old. It's about every day you get a little bit better.
Cool. Okay. Thanks a lot. I've realized loads of things I kind of want to talk to you about, but probably won't have time for everything. One thing was, what have you learned running a business with a wife who's running a similar size business?
I think it's good having a husband and wife, similar types of business and similar size business, because it's always tough if you've got all your eggs in one basket. So, there've been times when one business is going badly and the other business is going well and vice versa. And it makes it much easier. It takes the pressure off if you've got two businesses. And you can, in many ways, you can take more risks as well, because it's not the be-all and end-all. And there are a number of husband and wife teams who work in the same business, and a number of husband and wife teams who worked in the same business gone bust. And I think when you do that, that's quite a high risk, quite a high pressure. And it's nice having two similar businesses. We sort of don't talk about it that much anymore, but we used to. Yeah. I think the most interesting thing is, people sort of ask me how they can make their business successful. I mean, I don't actually think our business has been that successful, but it's where I am because I've done it for 32 years. And I just say to them, look, if you do it for 32 years, it'll be successful. And then you look at, with Chrissy and the White Company, she's very similar. And she didn't know anything about business at all. She started it from scratch. She was a journalist at Hobson Queen. And she's just carried on for 26 years. We're married, but they're still separate businesses started by people who just didn't take outside investment, didn't really take any debt, but just carried on for a long time. And I think it's a great example of what you can do if you just, it's about perseverance. And I think it's a real shame in this country, actually. There's a culture in England where as soon as you do half decently, you sell out. We have this sort of VC culture where people take a business from 0 to £10 million sales and they then sell. And that is the hard thing to do, is to take from 0 to 10. Somebody comes along, buys it, takes from 10 to 100, so makes it worth 10 times as much. And that's probably 10 times easier than going from 0 to 10. Whereas generally, they don't sell. BMW family have really stayed in those businesses and they've grown them and built them into great businesses. And I think it's a shame in this country that entrepreneurs tend to sort of sell out too early.
Do you think it helped, say you've both been in the same business, it might have been harder to focus for so long, so at the dinner table you can kind of talk about the other person's problems and be creative about a different business idea, but still be focused on your business during the normal business hours?
Yeah, it's good, yeah, because you both have similar sort of problem, but not the same problem. And you definitely learn off each other. I started my business before Chrissy started hers, and I think we made a lot of mistakes that I hope she didn't make, and I like to think she didn't make, because we'd already made them. I think it's great not being in the same business. I don't know any other husband and wife people who have separate businesses, really. But I do know ones who have the same business. And I think it quite often creates tension, actually, when you've got a husband and wife team working in a business together.
Interesting. Okay, well, probably going to take up too much of your time if I go further into relationships and businesses. So two more questions, if it's okay. One is, what is the kindest thing someone's ever done for you?
It's funny, I suppose kindness and finance don't really tend to go hand in hand. So whether it was a kind thing, not sure, but when I went bust in 94, went into receivership and I needed to, we had to buy the business out of receivership, didn't have any money. It was about 240,000 quid, which I just didn't have. And my father mortgaged his house and lent me the money. I think it was an amazing thing to do. I mean, it could have all gone bust, but he had that sort of faith in me. Charged me quite a lot of interest, actually. But he had that faith in me and risked his own house. And I think that was quite a kind thing. But again, it sort of feels slightly strange having kindness mixed up with lending money.
Yeah, but I guess it was a big act of faith. And
It was a big act of faith.
And I guess you definitely asked him for it.
I didn't ask him for it. I'd never have asked him for it. But he said he'd do it. And where would I be now if he hadn't done that? I don't know, because I couldn't have. I didn't have any money. So yeah. I guess I'd have gone off and done some other business. God knows what it would have been.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe you could have been like a multi-billionaire by now. Or maybe you'd have just been much happier. It's not all about money anyway.
I think that's one of the big lessons is you learn it's not about the money. And the awful thing is you have to make a bit of money to understand that. If you've made a bit of money and you say that, people just say it's all right for you to say that because you've made a bit of money. But to some of the unhappiest people I know are the people who've made the most money. Because you need to have something, you always need to be striving for something. You need to have a goal and a passion. And if you suddenly get there, wherever there is, it destroys a lot of people.
So one last question. What is your first memory?
My earliest memory is I always liked running backwards. And we used to have a chicken house. And I remember being with my father and running backwards around the chicken house. Don't know what that says.
Yeah, maybe that's
slightly strange
interpretation of that. Yeah.
Not much you can say to that, is it?
No. It's different. It's just strange, like the weird things that you do remember, I guess.
Yeah, it is odd. I guess I was probably four.
Yeah.
So you're really, I mean, another very early memory was watching my mother playing tennis, and she died when I was five. But I remember being up watching her playing tennis with the vicar. But I don't know what it is that makes you remember. I suppose the fact that she died when I was five would mean that any memory of her was, well, I suppose I remember it being an early memory because it's to be an aunt less than five.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
And, great. Good. Thank you very much.
So that's the end of the interview, which was just such a fascinating conversation with such an inspiring individual. There were just so many things that I learned in that episode. And that's not even the half of it, because I'm releasing a whole different episode with him on marketing on the marketing podcast. But anyway, let's go into my top three take-homes. Number one, be humble. The whole interview, Nick was incredibly humble and just accepting of his mistakes. A lot of his advice, he'd start with, well, this has been said before and I'm not a genius for thinking it, or this is what I think, but maybe it's not right. And he didn't really undermine his thoughts exactly, he just showed that he was open to being challenged or wrong about them, and that there could be other opinions that could also be right. And he's just super open to being wrong, and actively encourages his employees to challenge him and the authority across the organisation, to just ensure that people have a say in decisions and understand why things are the way they are, or have the power to actually change them. The feeling that you're being heard by someone that actually cares about your opinion is just hugely undervalued, I think, quite often. But it's an essential characteristic of an organisation that people want to be a part of. Number two, focus and perseverance. Things are really hard when starting, and it's so easy to quit when you don't find initial traction. And just getting things going takes a lot of time. Just to become an expert at what you do and to understand who your customer is and how to serve them. The world doesn't just stop and buy into your idea when you launch, so you shouldn't just give up. And then, when you have finally solved a problem, don't quit once you're doing well. Like Nick said, 0 to 10 is like the hardest thing to do. 10 to 100 is much, much easier. Yet so many people just sell out straight away when they finally get some success. So just don't lose attention and try other things, because you'll just mess up what you are doing. And just maintain relentless focus on the one thing. Number three, don't be afraid to break the mold. For a, quote, traditional business, unquote, Nick hasn't done anything traditionally. He didn't take financing or find a business partner. At the time he launched, it was actually a very innovative business model, and he ignored all his friends telling him to get a real job and just give up on this weird mail order shirt thing. In hindsight, it might all seem quite easy, but at the time, it takes real courage to be different. For me, a lot of my friends are asking why the hell I'm doing a postcard business. I've always had loads of app ideas and tech ideas. Why aren't I doing something with like blockchain or drones, etc.? Postcards will never scale, it's like old, stupid stuff. But sometimes you have to zag when everyone is zigging and just have the courage to do something that everyone thinks is stupid. So this has been really motivating for me, and hopefully will give you some motivation to stick and persevere with your own crazy ideas that maybe aren't actually that crazy, just perceived by everyone else in the world as crazy. So now on to books. We didn't really cover books in this episode, but during the warm-up questions, which I may have slightly messed up a bit, Nick did recommend a good book that he's been recently reading. What's your favourite swear word?
Is that a genuine question?
And it really pisses me off when people swear gratuitously.
Yeah, nice one, Sam. So that's the first and last time I ever ask that question is a warm-up question. But anyway, this did actually lead into some useful and kind of funny insights, including books, so we'll carry on.
Swear words are fine if they're used in the right context. I'm reading a book at the moment called Damaged Goods. It's a book by Oliver Shaw, who's now the business editor of the Sunday Times, about Philip Green. And I think Philip Green is the worst swearer in the world, probably. He is extremely liberal with his use of the most appalling swear words. But I think that's all part and parcel of his character. My 14-year-old swears like mad. You know, she's at that stage where she thinks swearing's really quite cool. And it's just extremely annoying. It really bugs me. So that makes me swear less, because I suddenly think I'm being a bit complete hypocrite.
Mm.
I start getting cross with her and then swear away myself. It's a bit like telling her not to use her phone, and then I'm on my bloody phone the whole bloody time.
Yeah, definitely.
You become aware of your hypocritical tendencies much more, and you try to sort of curb them. So swearing is one of those things that I try to do less of. But sometimes swearing is sort of, yeah, it's reasonable use of the English language.
So the book he recommended was Damaged Goods, The Inside Story of Sir Philip Green and the Collapse of BHS and the Death of the High Street by Oliver Shaw. So that's the end of this Growth Mindset episode. But if you learned a lot from Nick, this doesn't need to be the end. He mentioned that Charles Tewitt are experts at marketing, and so we have a whole podcast together on my Marketing Mindset podcast, where he reveals his biggest insights and failures from marketing.
When I first started, this in the days when, you know, mail order was just, you'd say, dear customer, and it would be a printed signature. And I absolutely insisted that it was dear the name, which now sounds ridiculous because it's easy to do. It wasn't easy to do, that nobody did it. And I would sign with my little ink pen. I would sign every letter, you know, so it was just personal. And sometimes I'd put a little PS on the bottom as well. You have to really think like the customer. You have to be the customer. The whole time you have to think, what does the customer want and what makes them want to buy? One of our brand values is that I want the business to be quirky and fun. It's just sort of different. And so we tend to write letters that are quirky and fun. And the danger with that is that you can get it wrong. I always used to write to people saying, you know, where are you? Where have you gone? People hadn't bought from us for a while. I'd be sort of quite direct and punchy. And you get people writing back, widows writing back, saying, my husband has gone to the other, you know, gone to the other side. Ooh, God, you know, this is not good.
All I can tell you is it's an awesome set of insights for anyone running a business or interested in marketing. So do head over to Marketing Mindset podcast to give it a listen. If you enjoy the show and want to encourage me to be creative and make more episodes just like this, then you can support me at my Patreon at patreon.com/growthmindset. So I love making these episodes for you, and I would love to dedicate more time to it and to just make the best podcast possible. And with your support, I can do that. Other benefits from becoming a patron will include the chance to ask questions on the show to me or to guests, and to suggest episode topics and suggest guests to be on the show. So if you like what I'm doing, send me some sweet supporting love. Or if you think the podcast is just terrible and really needs to improve, you can improve it with your money. Perfect. So head on over to patreon.com/growthmindset and join the crew from as little as $1. You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.